Hello, everybody. Terrence Pop here with another episode of Live from the Lair. And over the past year and a half, you know, I've been talking about the ESP thing. And periodically, I get emails from guys asking me to tell Army stories that reflect anything ESP-like. And I did this on the supporter stream. I got a whole bunch of stories that I remembered, wrote down. And I'm just going to go through a few here.
Dating in the Western world has never been more dangerous, expensive, or fruitless for men. But most of us just can't seem to stop doing it. Why?
Cause she different and she loves me.
Sure, buddy. Sure. As long as Western females continue to labor under the delusion that they're the prize, you need to pack up your toys and leave this slumber party massacre. And while you're waiting for the bus, get yourself a copy of Peace of Mind or Peace of Slot C, the ultimate men's guide to comprehending why, what, and how when it comes to women you're dealing with or dealt with. I'm not gonna lie, this subtitle could be shorter, like the men women won't date. There's a link in the meat gazer box, so start reading.
When I say ESP, okay, I am not like somebody who can like grab your hand, read your fortune. Okay, that's not me. In fact, I really, for the most part, don't have active control over it. It just happens from time to time. And ideally, when you need it most. Also, a lot of the ESP stories you can explain away with just experience and so forth. But somewhere those two things meet, okay? Like it could be a gut feeling or something going on and you just make the decisions that need to be done, or you take the actions that need to happen at that spot and you don't hesitate about it. All right, now, this one here, this first story. Now, I was at Abu Ghraib prison 2004. Okay. I remember the first Fallujah fight. I don't remember the exact date of when it went down. And at that particular time, I was kind of in the doghouse with my chain of command, and you know, they had me doing bullshit stuff, and I was not happy about it at first. But then I realized I had virtually no supervision. I was an E-8 Green Beret Airborne Ranger with a combat jump star and combat patch and 2 wars under my belt. So that gave me a lot of juice to go and speak with people and negotiate and make sure things are getting done correctly, or I was working, you know, top cover for individuals, or in the background I was pulling strings to make sure things were going smoothly for my guys. And this particular day, I had been going out with a couple of 5-tons on the convoy out to the Fallujah combat site before it kicked off. And there's a vast difference between the Marines and the Army. Like, the Marines really showed up 3 and 2 days before the attack and, like, literally lived under ponchos in fucked up conditions. And you could just tell the Marine Corps doesn't give a fuck about its fighters. They're just a walking wall of meat. And you can see it in the casualties they took and how they treated their wounded. And you can even hear the stupidity of how the Marines fought in combat on the radio. All right. And I know I'm upsetting any Marine fans out there because I'm saying stupid. I got it. I'm sorry. I'm from the college of fight harder, not smarter, or fight smarter, not harder, or the Marines, they fight harder, not smarter, and you can see the difference. They knew that the military, units that were there and the Marines that were there kind of got used to seeing me come around. I brought MREs and water and so forth, and tried to help out as much as I could. And then I got the word that, you know, it was going to kick off, mainly because they set up an alternate talk inside Abu that I, you know, spent a lot of time in, so I could see on the board exactly what was going on and who was doing what, where, and why. Okay, now, that alternate talk was never populated by the officers in charge or the commanding officers. It was just an alternate in case they needed it. So what that meant, it was staffed. It had all the boards. There were people in there updating everything. The radios were there. I mean, so quite base, you know, I was literally hearing what was being said and done, you know, through the upper chains of command. So, you know, it kicks off, and on that particular day, I had made three runs. Now, I wasn't the convoy commander, all right? I wasn't in charge. I just went along for the ride to do what I can do. So I get there, and there's the casualty collection points. There's one for the Marines. There's one for the Army. And it's being run completely differently. All right. Now, I remember talking to the gunny who was running the Marine Corps casualty collection point. I'm like, look, Abu's got a cache. It can do surgery. You know, they're only allowing me to take out the low priority guys or the walking wounded to go there. And do you have anyone that needs to see a surgeon immediately? And he's like, no, we got our choppers coming in. They're taking our people out. You're fine. So I start asking some questions because I was getting like this gut feeling like, you know, this doesn't sound right to me. So I'm like, when was the last helicopter here to pick up your guys? He's like, 45 minutes ago. And I had been there for maybe an hour and a half or so. And there were all kinds of choppers landing, but most of them were Army airframes. All right. I don't know if they were waiting for ones that were designated just for the Marines. And it wouldn't be the first time Marines follow orders to the letter and, you know, exclude all common sense. All right. So I'm literally at the casualty collection point. I'm like, you get in the truck. Yeah. And I look over and there's three Marines on stretchers. They're conscious, but they were tore pretty good. One was on his side because he had a sucking chest wound. Another guy had a tourniquet on his leg. I made a quick inquiry and his femoral artery had been severed. But it wasn't high up in the groin. It was lower, so they're able to get a tourniquet on it. But he had lost a lot of blood. And I just had this fucked up feeling. I'm like, nope. So I have, you know, 1 5-ton pretty much packed with dudes. I have another one that's 2/3 packed. I have room for more people. And then I go to the Marine, the gunny, and I'm like, look, these three guys in stretchers, you know, I can have them on an operating table. It's only 8 miles away by truck. All right. Because the way your choppers are coming in, these guys are going to die. I mean, they're losing blood. They're fucked up. It's hot as fuck. And I'm like, all right, gunny, just do me a favor. All you got to do is just walk over there and ignore me for 3 minutes. These guys are gone. And then we can say our sorries and work it out after the fact. So he didn't say anything, but he did walk away. So, you know, I think he agreed with what I was going to do. It's just, you know, the way the Marine culture is, it is what it is. So I was giving him plausible deniability why these three guys just disappeared. And I'm like, all right, on the truck. And quite literally, you know, I had a bunch of grunts down there and they pick up these guys. They stick them on the truck. And, of course, they're fucking with the Marines the whole time. Like, hey, you couldn't get out of the fucking way, you dumbass. Blah, blah, blah. And the guy with the sucking chest wound is like, he can barely breathe. He's like, fuck off. I'm like, all right. So, you know, we roll back to the cache. I get these three guys spun up, go on the table, get stabilized. And then they get flown to the green zone where they get like higher level surgical intervention. And then from there they go to wherever they were supposed to go. Now, typically that's usually Langstuhl, Germany, or the Navy Marine guys get flown to Bethesda in the United States, which is a whole clusterfuck in it, of itself. I mean, the flight there is long. If people are really fucked up, I mean, I just don't understand why the Marines and the Army don't get along better. So I'm pretty sure those at least one of those three guys, you know, would have died. Because the ER nurse, after the fact, is like, yeah, that Marine you brought in, he wouldn't have made it another 40 minutes. He was, they had a tourniquet on there, but it wasn't stopping everything. And, you know, we had to give him, I gave him like 2 units of blood just to stabilize him and then repack it and surgically, you know, repair the bullet hole or the nick in the artery. And then he got sent forward. So I don't really know what happened to those guys. Let's see. Okay, next one. All right, now, I had been moved to NCOIC of security for the entire base of Abu Ghraib. And NCOIC stands for non-commissioned officer in charge. So I run all the daily activities. I handle a large majority of the decisions that need to be made. I manage contracts, money, whatever, is if it pertained to the prison. And I only really involved my higher-ups if I needed horsepower to get something done. For the most part, I didn't. And I had set up a lot of different procedures when I took over. You know, I had a bunch of piles of dirt put in with Tanglefoot to stop car bombs from getting right up to the walls. I had broken glass bottles, you know, cemented on the top of the walls with concertina wire just to keep people out. Because you can throw a blanket over the concertina wire and you should be okay. It's another thing when you have the bottom of a broken wine bottle sticking up and your weight comes down, it will fucking cut you. I did that. I put in the, made sure there were dogs at the front gate, you know, and that later on became a problem in like 2006 because, you know, Haji hates dogs. And what are you going to do? I put it up there. I had them put up there for psychological reasons, basically to keep bad guys from being stupid. And one of the things I would do is I would go to each tower just as the sun was coming up and I would take a digital photograph. I had a set of binos. It was like 2 or 3 megapixels at the time. Very expensive. Now they're dirt cheap, almost worthless. And I would take a picture. I would go back to the top and I would compare pictures. And on 2 different occasions, you know, I remember there was a vehicle I had not seen. And I remember one was a Ford Probe. So I'm like, okay, I look at the picture and I just got this really weird gut feeling. And I'm like, So I get the Marine Corps QRF. We spin them up. We roll out there to inspect the vehicle. We walk up to it. And the only thing in the car was the front seat. They had ripped out the passenger seat. They had ripped out the back seat, the paneling, everything. Okay, now, for those of you that aren't familiar, that's what they do. Because the guy who's going to drive it, it's a one-way trip. They take out everything else. They pack the inside of the car and the trunk with explosives. And sometimes they even go inside the quarter panels and the rear fenders and just pack as much shit in there as they can. And then they drive up to what they're going to do and boom. And quite a few car bomb attacks that were happening on a fairly regular basis. And usually the car bomb would roll up to a checkpoint and then detonate. And like 4 to 6 individuals nearby would literally get turned to red paste with just bits of boots left behind. So we came out, we saw it. I'm like, okay. I then go back. I spin up the CBs. They come out with a bulldozer. We flip the car over, smash it up, and like the Haji's out there throwing a fit. I don't fucking care. Same thing happened, but this one was an older station wagon, and they had just taken out the back two rows of seats. That would have been a huge car bomb. We did the same thing, just smashed it up, flipped it over. So that was a gut feeling esp thing. Another one, we had individuals that would come in, local nationals that worked inside the prison. And I was not a fan of this, but hey, it is what it is. Those decisions were made way above me. And I would always like to keep an eye on them. And sometimes I would assign individuals to, you know, keep an eye out above and beyond the escort detail that was going with all these people. Because quite frankly, it's hot. You know, sometimes the escort detail, especially if it's the same guys, they just get used to it. It's a routine thing. They don't pay as much attention. So I would have a second set of eyes that's not caught in that whole dynamic watching. And on three different occasions, I caught Haji pacing off targets inside the prison. Now, for those of you that don't know what this is, you set up a mortar, you fire some rounds at your target, you take the mortar apart, you write down all the dope, all the information, elevation, and what have you, and you remove the equipment and you leave quickly. And then you have people on the inside find those impacts, and then from there they just pace off the distance, direction and distance to a major target that they do want to hit. That information gets relayed back. They come back, set up the mortar exactly how it was before, put the same dope on the sights, they make the adjustments, and they fire again. And they'll do that two and three times. And quite frankly, by the second or third time they do that, it's fairly accurate. It might not be timed correctly, but it is fairly accurate. So we caught these three dudes, and, you know, again, it was that gut feeling. I caught them pacing, and immediately they got the black bag, and they went right to the whip me, spank me camp. I wasn't even fucking around with that shit. I didn't want to, you know, see people. Well, I'm just not going to have people needlessly killed on my watch, especially if I could stop it from happening. Let's see. All right. Now, this is a big one here. I was on a convoy going down to one of the port cities in Iraq, and it was a significant drive. It was like a 2-day thing. You know, we drove for most of the first day and part of the second day, and then we got to the destination. All right, so we had made it to our holdover point. You know, we refueled, racked out, ate, drank our water, what have you. And the next day, we rolled out. Now, I was not the convoy commander. I was not in charge. I was in the vehicle of the convoy commander at the time. And, you know, we reviewed all of the routes, the primary alternate contingency routes. And everything was copacetic in Tull. The second day, we've been driving for like an hour. And I get the convoy commander's attention. We pull over. I tell him, look, the primary route that you want to go on, I'm having a really bad feeling about it. Can we take the alternate route just for that leg of the journey? He's like, no problem, sir. Not a big deal. And it was some captain. I don't remember his name. So we take that. We get to our destination. I didn't think anything about it. Well, that night, the captain calls me to his chew, which where he was staying. And he goes, how did you know that route we were going to take was going to be, you know, contested? And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, after we went to the the alternate route, there was a convoy that went down that same route 30 minutes later and just got decimated. They lost like 30% of their people, had two or three vehicles deadlined and destroyed on the spot. They had to call in air assets. It was just a huge clusterfuck. That was straight up gut feeling thing right there. And it's hard to explain, you know, and this is like before the TBI. Because, you know, after the TBI, the ESP went up, you know, a lot. You know, it went up a lot more. I can't put a number on it. It's hard to explain. So to this day, when I get gut feelings, I pay attention. Because I'm not the only one out there that gets these gut feelings. And I'm just wondering if the world would be a better place if more people just listen to what their gut is trying to tell them. Because sometimes that makes all the difference.